If you were here last week, you'll know that we are looking at a small series of three over these Sunday evenings at All Souls called The God I Don't Understand. And for many people, the God I don't understand would be very easy to identify. He's the God of the Old Testament. In fact, those who wish to deride the Christian faith in general find their sharpest ammunition ready-made in the pages of the Old Testament. For example, there's the great tele-evangelist of atheism, Richard Dawkins, and this is what he has to say about the God of the Old Testament. Just thought you'd like to know this. The God of the Old Testament, says Dawkins, is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving, control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. That's Richard Dawkins' view of the God of the Old Testament. I think I'll put it down here rather than have it on the same level as my Bible. Now, the problem is that some of us wince when we read words like that, not just because they are offensive, which they are, but because we sometimes have a sneaking full feeling that we think the same thing when we read the Old Testament. Isn't that sometimes what God appears like? What are we to make of texts in the Bible which speak about God meeting out horrific punishments on whole families, as he does with Achan or Korah or the sons of Aaron? And most of all, what about the Canaanites? And of course, by that phrase, I'm referring to the story in the book of Joshua about the invasion of the land of Canaan by the Israelites under Joshua himself, driving out and destroying the inhabitants of the land. Is there any way to describe such a thing other than genocide, ethnic cleansing? So again, Dawkins can say, the Bible story of Joshua's destruction of Jericho and the invasion of the Promised Land in general is morally indistinguishable from Hitler's invasion of Poland or Saddam Hussein's massacre of the Kurds and the Marsh Arabs. Well, we find such things very disturbing. At least I hope you do. I certainly do. I don't like these things any more than you do. Or say that it's easy to understand God when we read those parts of the Bible. We're particularly disturbed because we know that those parts of the Bible have been used all down the centuries of Christendom by professing Christian leaders right up to modern times as a justification for things like torture and execution and conquest and horrifying punishments and racist genocide, claimed to have theological justification from the Old Testament. Going quickly through the centuries, the Crusades, the genocide of North American Indians, apartheid against black South Africans, the treatment of the Palestinians, even the attitude towards Roman Catholics in Northern Ireland, have all drawn from this source the idea that our enemies are cursed by God, like the Canaanites, and we are justified in wiping them out. And even today, some people are asking the question, is there really any difference between radical Islamic violence justified from scriptures and what we read in the Old Testament about the conquest of Canaan? Now, of course, we can't blame the Old Testament for the ways that Christians have misused it. But it's bad enough in itself, it would seem to us, even without the way Christians have used it. What possible connection can there be between all this violence that's there in the Bible and the God of love that we are supposed to trust and understand? Well, what I want to do, first of all, is to look very quickly at three, I think, wrong solutions to this idea, this problem, and try to deal with those reasonably quickly, and then move on to what I hope are three rather more helpful, at least hopefully helpful, perspectives on the matter. The first way in which some people try to get out of this is just to say, well, I mean, that's your typical Old Testament for you, isn't it? That's what it's like there, but thankfully we've got the New Testament, which puts it all right. And I would say this is probably the easiest and most popular way out of the difficulty. You just set the New Testament over against the Old. We're New Testament Christians, we like to say. And we know either God was never really like that in the first place, even though the Israelites thought he was, or that, well, maybe he was like that once, but now he's radically changed the way he deals with us because Jesus has come. And that's a very common idea. The Old Testament God is filled with brimstone, war, vengeance, violence, blood, and punishment. But thank God the God of the New Testament, we're told, is much nicer altogether. And Jesus showed us how much he really loves and cares for us. Maybe God had to do all that stuff in Old Testament times, but really he rather does things differently now. So New Testament cancels out the Old. But this simply won't do. It won't do for at least three reasons. It won't do first because the Old Testament actually has as much to say about the love and compassion of God as the New Testament does. In fact, statistically, much more. We haven't time, but I'd love to take you through all the Psalms which talk about the love, compassion, forgiveness, and grace of God. Moses defines God as compassionate and gracious and slow to anger. The psalmist says that he was not angry all the time and that he is loving and faithful to all. And we've just been doing a series here, It All Souls, on Hosea, who spoke warmly of the love of God, bringing his people back to him as Hosea brought his adulterous wife back to himself. So we can't dismiss this by just saying it's typical of the so-called hateful God of the Old Testament. The Old Testament teaches us as much about the love and forgiveness of God as the New Testament. And secondly, it won't do in reverse, because actually the New Testament has just as much to say, in fact a lot more, about the anger and judgment and ultimate wrath of God than the Old Testament does. When we turn to the New Testament, is it true that it only speaks of a God of love, and all the wrath and punishment has somehow been superseded? Well, very far from it. The fact is that Jesus spoke more about hell than anybody else in the New Testament. The word hell only occurs 12 times in the New Testament, and 11 of them come from Jesus in the Gospels. He spoke warnings about fire, about remorse, about outer darkness. That's the language that comes from the loving warnings of Jesus. And other New Testament writers follow this up. The writer to the Hebrews, for example, says that anyone who rejected the law of Moses in the Old Testament died without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. How much more severely, he says, in the New Testament, do you think a man deserves to be punished who has trampled the Son of God underfoot? That's the New Testament. So the idea that the New Testament just gets us out of it really doesn't work. And the third reason why this won't do is because actually the New Testament simply accepts the stories of the Old Testament without apparent embarrassment or correction. Of course, I know that Jesus did bring new wine that couldn't quite fit in the old wineskins. Yes, he went beyond the teaching of the Old Testament in many, many ways. Yes, he did tell his disciples, as we saw in our gospel reading, to respond in different ways and to reject violence and vengeance. But never in the gospels or in the rest of the letters of the Old Testament do Jesus or the apostles criticize or correct the words and actions of God that are recorded in the Old Testament, or teach us that somehow they were immoral or wrong. On the contrary, even some of those horror stories of the Old Testament are actually used in the New Testament, either as examples of faith or as warnings of judgment to come, as the flood is used by Jesus in Matthew, and Sodom and Gomorrah, Korah and the conquest. All of these earthly stories in the Old Testament are picked up and used in the New Testament as examples and warnings of God's judgment. So I don't think we can dodge out of this issue by simply putting the one against the other. Secondly, a second way in which some people try to get out of this problem is to say, well, you see, it's the Israelites' fault. They thought that this was what God had commanded them, but actually they were wrong. The Israelites themselves, of course, we know they attacked, they drove out the Canaanites. They probably thought they had no other option. They needed somewhere to live. They couldn't go on living in the wilderness forever. And so, yes, they conquered the Canaanites. And then they rationalized that action as the will and command of their God, Yahweh. They did what they thought God was commanding them to, but they were wrong. The nice, neat thing about that solution is that we can now blame the Israelites for the slaughter of the Canaanites, but not blame God, which, of course, is neat. So God gets implicated by the Israelites, but we don't accept their interpretation. We can blame the Israelites and keep God's hands clean. But again, I'm sorry, I have to say, this really won't work. Because in the rest of the Bible, everywhere else, the conquest is not only explained as the will and command of God, but even emphasized as that. In Genesis, we read that God promised Abraham that he would bring his people back into this land. In Exodus, God promised the Israelites in Egypt that he would not only bring them out, but that he would bring them into the promised land. So it's linked to the redemption. The psalmists confirm that God's conquest was not even the work of human hands at all, but was the power of God. They repeatedly say that. The prophet saw it as one of the greatest acts of God in the history of the Old Testament. And even in the New Testament, get this, both Stephen and Paul refer to the conquest simply as an act of God's great sovereignty in history. So it's placed within the overall plan and purpose of God in the Bible. I don't think we can get away with just saying that Moses and Joshua were very sincere, but they made a serious error of judgment. They thought wrongly that in attacking the Canaanites they were obeying God, and then they imagined that God was giving them victory. Because if they were misguided about such an important thing, then so were all the other Old Testament and New Testament speakers and writers who describe it in exactly the same way. I don't think we can take a surgeon's knife and just cut the conquest out, the nasty bit out of the Bible history, and say it was all the mistaken actions of bloodthirsty warriors and leave the rest of the story intact. Well, I don't think we can do that if we want to take the Bible seriously, at least. The third way in which some people try to handle this is to use a particular fancy piece of footwork that is very popular with preachers and is also probably the commonest way in which many people handle these passages when they read them in their personal quiet time or have to study them in a Bible study group or something like that. And that is to say, well, it's all allegory. It's all meant to give us a spiritual lesson. You can get some spiritual truth out of it somewhere. And so the Exodus can be a picture of God releasing us from slavery and sin. The wilderness can be a picture of all the trials and temptations we struggle with in our earthly pilgrimage. And so the conquest can be a picture of our battle with Satan, all the spiritual hosts of darkness. And so we can use the language of marching on the land with our swords drawn, or trumpet calls, or putting the enemy to flight, or tearing down the strongholds and gaining the victory, and lots of Joshua, Jordan, Jericho, and jingles, and we put it all to wonderfully lively, upbeat music, and yeah, that's it. We've dealt with a conquest. Now, I don't want to completely dismiss that kind of spiritual approach, because it is partly there in the Bible. The Bible uses this story as a warning, as an encouragement, and as a metaphor for the way in which God deals with spiritual enemies, including Satan. And yes, the New Testament can use the image of the Old Testament conquest as a way of describing God's victory over sin and Satan at the cross of Christ. And yes, the New Testament uses the conquest as a spiritual warning about the final day of judgment. All of those things are true, but whatever spiritual lessons we draw from this are secondary. The story itself is not an allegory. The story is presented to us as history, as events which happened on the soil of Canaan. See, the whole point about an allegory is that it's a made-up story in which the spiritual truth is primary and the content of the story could be almost anything. When you read Pilgrim's Progress, for example, you know that John Bunyan is trying to teach you spiritual lessons about the journey of life as a Christian. And the whole story just comes out of his imagination. You could say the same thing about the way C.S. Lewis presents a whole Christian worldview, but does it through the fictional stories of the Chronicles of Narnia. But when we read the conquest, it's not like that. The people in these stories were not allegorical Israelites, and it wasn't allegorical Canaanites who got slaughtered. So whatever spiritual lessons we may choose to draw then, I think we need a better solution. So those are some ways in which I think people come to attempted solutions that seem helpful but actually don't really deal with the problem. Well, if they don't, is there any better one? And so I offer you three of what I've called here hopefully helpful perspectives. I don't want to claim that they solve the problem. In fact, I'm coming to the view after years of wrestling with this issue and thinking around it as an Old Testament teacher that really there is no solution to this issue. I think this is one of those things which I simply have to leave within my basket of things that I don't really fully understand about God and about the ways of God. But there are some considerations. There are some perspectives that I think help. They don't solve it in the sense of they just remove all the emotional and moral pain and all the horror and revulsion that we feel when we read these stories. But they do at least, for me, help my faith. And I offer them to you for the same reason. See, one of the problems is that when we read this story or horrible little bits of it, as we usually do when we're just reading an isolated text from Joshua or Deuteronomy or something, we try to find a meaning for that little passage or maybe an excuse for it. When what we really need to do is to set this whole episode within the wider framework of the whole Bible. In fact, we need to get into the habit of doing that with any part of the Bible that we read. So let's look at three frameworks which I think will help us to put the conquest in a proper perspective. I'm going to ask that we look at it in the framework of the Old Testament story as a whole, within the framework of God's sovereign justice, and within the framework of God's plan of salvation. Each of those I'll try to deal with reasonably concisely. First of all, then, we need to set this story within the framework of the Old Testament story. Now, when we do that and set this event within the culture and history of Old Testament, at least two things happen, I think. One is that we're reminded of the culture and the rhetoric of ancient warfare in the ancient world. Now, we should not actually call the conquest holy war. That's a term which is sometimes used today about these things. It's a term never used in the Bible. Conquest is described as a war of Yahweh, the God of the Israelites, in which he fought against his and their enemies. And in that context, the harem, or the ban, was applied, which meant the total dedication through destruction of all that was being attacked, human or animal or material, to God himself. Now, there were exceptions, but in the Canaanite wars, that was the general rule. Now, what we need to see is that this is not something unique to Israel itself. There are lots of other texts from other nations which show that this kind of total destruction in war was practiced, or at least proudly claimed, elsewhere. We also need to recognize that there is a rhetoric about this, a way of talking about this kind of thing, which was often much more absolute and universal than reality on the ground. Now, this doesn't remove the problem, because the reality on the ground was still pretty horrible. But I think that at least it helps us to see that sometimes the descriptions about destroying everything that lives and breathes, for example, was not necessarily intended literally, even within the Old Testament. So, for example, we read in the book of Joshua that all the land was captured, all the kings were killed, all the people without survivors were destroyed, all the cities were torn down. That's what it says in Joshua 10 and 11. But this must be a kind of rhetorical generalization, because when you come to the book of Judges, whose writer must have known those passages in Joshua, he sees no contradiction in telling us that this process went on for a long time, that there were many inhabitants that were still there were cities that weren't captured, there was land that hadn't been destroyed. The key fortified cities were destroyed, but in fact the process went on for a long time. So the Old Testament recognizes rhetoric and generalization, and I think so should we. The other side of this, putting it in the context of the Old Testament, is to say that the conquest of Canaan was a unique and limited event within that Old Testament history. Now, it's a single episode, stories of the conquest, and it happens within a single generation, even though it goes both backwards and forwards in significance. The conquest was promised to Abraham. It was anticipated in the slavery in Egypt. It was delayed by rebellion in the wilderness. It was accomplished under Joshua, and it was more or less finished off under David. But although it spans that history, the actual invasion, warfare, and destruction took place within a single generation. Now, there are many other wars in the Old Testament, which is not really surprising because the Old Testament covers about 1,000 years of human history. So it's not at all surprising that you get a bit of warfare in it. And some of those wars were approved by God, but many were not. Many of the wars of the Israelites are clearly condemned as the actions of proud and greedy kings or military rivals. It's simply a caricature, it seems to me, to say that the Old Testament God is just always on the warpath. No, this is a limited event, which was never meant, as I read the Old Testament, was never meant to become a model for how all future generations were to actually then behave towards their enemies, whether future generations of Israelites or even still less of Christians. One thing, it seems to me, is that this was described as an act of God rather than a military action of Israel. When the Psalms and prophets come to talk about the conquest, you see, they lay all their emphasis upon this being what God had done, not on the achievements of Israel. Here's, for example, what one psalm says, Psalm 44. It says to God, "With your hand you drove out the nations and planted our fathers. It was not by their sword that they won the land, nor did their arm bring them victory. It was your right hand, your arm, and the light of your face, for you loved them." So the conquest, you see, was a monument to God's faithfulness, not to Israel's military power. And when we look at it in that way, that I think helps us also to understand how Jesus, in the gospel reading we just had in Luke 9, could prohibit his disciples from emulating the violence of the Old Testament without condemning the Old Testament itself, which is what Jesus does, I think. That gospel reading in Luke chapter 9, James and John want Jesus to call down fire from heaven on those Samaritan villages because they were rejecting Jesus. They were probably thinking of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. And Jesus rebuked them and says, that's not the way that Jesus or his disciples are to behave now, or even to ask God to do so. But the fact that Jesus and his disciples do not imitate this Old Testament story does not mean that Jesus regarded the event itself as inherently wrong at the time. Now that leads on to a second major framework that I want to bring before you. And to me, this is actually perhaps the most important perspective that the Bible offers on understanding the conquest. And it's the framework of God's sovereign justice and punishment. Because that is the framework in which the Bible consistently and repeatedly puts this piece of history. And I personally believe that this makes a major difference to how we read and understand this story. In fact, not only does the Old Testament put this particular piece of history in the light of God acting in judgment upon a wicked society and culture, but shows God doing the same thing again and again and again within Old Testament history. In that sense, this is not a unique story in terms of what it illustrates of God's actions in history. Now, the first thing about this particular framework, the first of 3 points, is that the Old Testament describes the wickedness of Canaanite culture and religion and society very graphically indeed. We saw this in that first Old Testament reading that we had in Deuteronomy chapter 9, but that's certainly not the first time that we read it. In fact, if you go right back to Genesis, God anticipates this when he says to Abraham that Abraham's descendants will possess the land of Canaan, but not yet. Why not yet? Because, says God, I'm quoting, in the fourth generation your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites, which is also another word for the Canaanites, has not yet reached its full measure, says God to Abraham in Genesis 15, verse 16. Now what that means is that in Abraham's day, God saw that the Canaanite society was not yet so wicked as to morally justify God acting in comprehensive judgment upon it. But, says God, that time will come. Now, we know from the Bible that all human beings and all nations are sinful in one way or another. But there seem to be times, the Bible tells us, when extreme human wickedness and degradation and immorality call down God's signal acts of judgment. Times when God deems such action to be right, and other times when he withholds it. And only God discerns the difference. So the wickedness of the Canaanites is anticipated in Genesis. It's described in Leviticus. I've put some of the references there on the screen, Leviticus chapter 18 and 20, and again in Deuteronomy chapter 12. It includes all the degradation of the fertility cults of nature, with sexual promiscuity and perversion, and indeed to the extreme of the sacrifice of children, probably the result of sacred prostitution, to their gods. And all of that kind of perverted religion went along with the sort of political and social and economic oppression and greed that is typified by Jezebel later in the story, who was a Canaanite queen. Now, Leviticus is very graphic. It's God says, you know, those people, they're in this land. And God says, the land itself will vomit them out. That's the graphic imagery of chapter 18. That says to me that what the situation had become was so repulsive and disgusting to God that he couldn't stomach it any longer. So the conquest of Canaan was not human genocide, it was divine judgment. And that interpretation is not only presented to us repeatedly in the Old Testament, it's accepted in the New. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 31 describes the Canaanites as the disobedient ones, in contrast to Rahab, who we're going to look at in just a moment. In other words, it suggests that the Canaanites had been morally aware of their sin, but deliberately chose not to repent of it, but to persist in their wickedness against the voice even of their own conscience. So it's set then in the context of punishment. Now, I don't know about you, but I think that that makes a difference, because the context of punishment makes a different moral framework for any act of violence, even at a minimum level. I don't know what you think about smacking children. You may think it's totally wrong. But I would say that on those occasions when I did smack my sons for willful disobedience to something that I explained they weren't to do, and then they did it, and I smacked them, that that is a very different action in the context of punishment than if I walked into a children's nursery and just picked up a child and started beating it. I'd be arrested, quite rightly, because that is arbitrary, meaningless violence. So the same action can be quite different when there's a context of punishment, and I think that helps, at least it helps me. Because the Bible repeatedly says that the conquest was an act of God's judgment upon a wicked human society using the Israelites as the human agent of God's judgment. But that brings us to a second important point. Just because God used the Israelites as the agent of his judgment did not mean that the Israelites themselves were pure and righteous. See, because that's what we always want to say when we are involved in any conflict. The temptation in human warfare is to demonize the enemy and make your own side look lily white. At least that's the script of Hollywood movies. It's all simply goodies and baddies, black and white. And God knew that the Israelites would fall into the same temptation. Whenever they won victories in Canaan, they would think that it was their righteousness. And that is what Deuteronomy 9 is telling them. It was not because of their righteousness. They deserved to be destroyed, and it was only God's grace that they weren't. Later on, God would use the Assyrians and the Babylonians also as the agent of his judgment, and that didn't make them righteous either. And indeed, thirdly, God threatened to do exactly the same to the Israelites as he had done to the Canaanites. He warned them about that, said, if you become like the Canaanites, I will treat you like my enemy, and the land that vomited them out will vomit you out also. So there's a moral consistency about what God did. In fact, you could argue that in the Old Testament, far more generations of Israelites felt the judgment of God at the hand of their enemies than the single generation of Canaanites that experienced the judgment of God at the hands of the Israelites. So that's a second major framework. And finally and thirdly, we come to this one, the framework of God's plan of salvation. You see, I've said all along that we need to set the conquest within the whole Bible story, even though it's such a grim narrative. But the whole Bible story is a story of salvation. And it's interesting to me that the first thing we notice when we start reading the story of the conquest is that it's got a story of salvation right up front. Her name's Rahab. It's a story of conversion, faith, and salvation within the story of judgment. Here is a Canaanite, this woman, who, like the rest of her fellow Canaanites, she says, recognizes the power of the God of the Israelites by the things that he had done. But Rahab chooses, unlike the other Canaanites, to change sides and to put her trust in this God and in his people. And so when we actually cross the Jordan with the Israelites into Canaan, the very first Canaanite we actually meet in the narrative is a converted one who gets saved. So Rahab was spared the judgment, and redemption operates. We have no way of knowing whether Rahab was an astonishing exception or whether she was an example that was followed by others. We just don't know. Were there other Canaanites who believed in the God of Israel but didn't have Israelite spies dropping in on them to give their testimony to? Were there Canaanites secret believers? I don't know. But we do know that there were groups like the Gibeonites and the Jebusites who were accepted into Israel. And we also know that Rahab was so important that she's referred to three times in the New Testament. In the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew, as a model of faith by Hebrews, and in an example of works proving faith in action by James. So that's the first thing. The story has salvation within it. Secondly, setting it within this context of God's plan of salvation, if we go right back to the beginning, then we see that the whole story starts with the promise of blessing that God made to Abraham in Genesis 12, verses 1 to 3. God promised to Abraham that he would bless all the nations on the earth. That raises problems, because as soon as we move from Genesis to Joshua, we have to ask, how on earth was the arrival of the Israelites in Canaan any kind of blessing to the Canaanites? And the answer is, of course, that at that moment in history, the Israelites were not sent to bring the blessing of God, but the judgment of God, as we've just seen. God's ultimate long-range purpose of bringing blessing to all the nations of humanity didn't mean that God then just would be nice to everybody, no matter what they did or how they behaved. God is still the moral judge of all nations and still has the right to act in judgment upon particular nations, as he did for Israel. God promised to bless the Israelites, made a covenant with them, and yet he acted repeatedly upon them in judgment. And so it is with humanity at large. And finally, to Psalm 47, within this context of the conquest, within the story of salvation. Here is a paradox. Would you turn to Psalm 47, if you could, just in these closing moments? Because the ultimate paradox is, in this psalm, that the nations themselves are going to come to praise God for his salvation, the history of which includes the conquest. I wish I'd got time, of course I don't, to tell you all that the Old Testament says about God's purposes for the nations. But Psalm 47 begins, "Clap your hands, all you nations. Shout to God with cries of joy." The writer invites the nations to give a round of applause to Yahweh, the God of Israel. Now, clapping is a sign of appreciation. You clap because you're grateful about something. It's brought you pleasure or benefit. So what does this psalmist say the nations will clap Yahweh, the God of Israel, for? Well, it says, "Because he subdued nations under us and peoples under our feet." Verse 3, that's the conquest. The nations are being asked to clap Yahweh, the God of Israel, because he's the God who defeated them under the Israelites. Now, that's pretty cynical, isn't it? I mean, that's a bit like saying, "Well, we invaded you, but you really ought to be grateful to us." Not totally unprecedented, that kind of cynicism, but I think there's something more profound here in this psalm. The nations can be called to applaud God because ultimately even the historical defeat of these Canaanite nations by Israel will be seen to be part of that overall history of salvation for which all nations of humanity will ultimately praise God. The God who punished the Canaanites is also the great king of all the earth. And when this king comes to reign, says the psalm and the rest of the Bible, then all nations will be the beneficiaries. In the end, the history of Old Testament Israel, even including the conquest, will be the subject of praise among the nations because of the saving benefit that it brings to mankind in the long range, because of what we know, of course, from the rest of the Bible. So we come to my conclusion. As I struggle to understand this and to relate this nasty part of biblical history to the rest of the God that I worship, I have to ask myself, where do I stand? As I read Psalm 47, where do I find myself? I'm not an ancient Israelite like the original author and readers and singers of that psalm, nor am I an original Canaanite, one of the conquered nations of verse 3. But I do stand among the nations over whom God is sovereign. And either I stand among them as one who remains in rebellion against God and under God's judgment, with this, which this story warns me to take very seriously, or I stand among the redeemed of God from all the nations, those who are summoned to clap my hands and give praise to the God of Israel in the Old Testament, the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Because in that sense, and in Christ, I am part of this people. the people of the God of Abraham. For this story is part of the story of my salvation. The Bible tells me that this is the way that God, in his sovereignty, chose to work within human history to accomplish his saving purpose for humanity, for creation, and for me. I may not like it. I don't really like it. I may deplore the violence, the suffering that is there. But even when I accept the verdict that it is God's judgment and it was warranted, I still find myself wishing there could have been some other way. But at some point I have to stand back from my criticism, from my complaint, and receive the Bible's own word on this matter. The conquest of Canaan was an act of God with an overarching narrative through which the only hope of the world's salvation was accomplished. And finally, within that overall perspective, the road to Canaan was one small stretch along the road to Calvary. And when I set this part of the Bible in the light of the cross of Christ, then I see one last perspective. Because, of course, the cross also involved the most horrific human violence, which at the same time simultaneously was also the outpouring of God's judgment on human sin, as the conquest is described. The crucial difference, of course, is this, that whereas in the conquest, God poured out his judgment upon a wicked society that deserved it, at the cross, God bore upon himself the judgment of God on human wickedness in the person of his own sinless Son who deserved it not one bit. And that is why it's totally appropriate that we move from hearing this message and thinking about these scriptures to what we're about to do in our communion service, which is to come back to the cross of Christ as those who have been and would still be the enemies of God and standing under his judgment, were it not for his love, his grace, his forgiveness that is available to us through the blood of Christ, his only Son.